If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Okay, so today is one of those episodes of Gabbing with Gib where we're going to veer outside the Bravo universe for a second, but I still hope it's a topic that enough of you are interested in because I know it's an area of pop culture that I've always found fascinating, the royals. I don't remember the first time I became aware of the British royal family as a kid growing up in America, but I do remember the Princess Diana Beanie Baby. That really is my first kind of memory associated with anything royals. I remember adults' fascination with Diana in general, and my mom loves the royals, but my own personal interest wasn't really piqued again until 2011 when Prince William married Kate Middleton. I remember watching their wedding on TV and some teachers live streaming the news during school as they replayed footage from their instantly iconic wedding, and I remained interested after that, but not intensely so, until I spent the first 5 years of my career working at Entertainment News, where anything involving the royals clicked extremely well, so we leaned fully in and covered them a lot. And those years of covering pop culture in that sort of day-to-day 24-hour news cycle sense coincided almost exactly with the introduction and subsequent fascination with Meghan Markle and the royal world. I remember covering the rumors that this random actress from Suits, a show I still have never seen a full episode of despite having a huge moment on Netflix this year, was dating the Prince of England. And I remember their first outing together at the Invictus Games, what a big deal that was. I remember mining her Instagram account for content to just tell us more about her. And then the subsequent minor scandals that obviously led to bigger ones. And we woke up and came into the office when it was still dark out to cover their wedding in 2018. And I remember just being excited by the prospect of what Meghan was bringing to the royal family and what it could represent to the world. In my experience covering celebrities, especially the ones that you cover closely, spending so much time reading up on them, keeping up with them, writing about them so closely that, you know, it either makes you love them or it makes you loathe them. And this made me love the royals, but more specifically Meghan, a lot. I felt invested in her and the full acceptance I'd hoped that she would receive, but ultimately never got. Her story with Harry has been one of the defining pop culture stories of the past 5 years, and I've kept up with it at more of an arm's length until a big new project drops or we get a big media event, and then I tap back in. So the Oprah interview, the Netflix special, Meghan's podcast for Spotify, Harry's book earlier this year, and Finding Freedom, the 2020 bestseller written by a longtime royal correspondent by the name of Omid Scobie, that provided the first intimately detailed account of the Sussexes' decision to lead the royal family and move to North America. While Harry and Meghan weren't directly involved in the book, members of their team, it later came out, did provide information for the author to include. So the information here was legit, and the book took Omid's career, and with it, a level of scrutiny, particularly in the British media, which famously tends to be unusually critical of Meghan, to the next level. In November of this year, Omid released his now best-selling follow-up book, Endgame, Inside the Royal Family and the Monarchy's Fight for Survival, which, to quote the book's official description, is a, quote, explosive book that provides a penetrating investigation into the current state of the British monarchy. An unpopular king, a power-hungry heir to the throne, a queen willing to go to dangerous lengths to preserve her image, and a prince forced to start a new life after being betrayed by his own family. It's an incredibly well-researched, well-sourced, and juicy read that paints each and every primary character here in a slightly new light. Like, I really did learn something new about each individual person, and it wasn't all positive and it wasn't all negative. Like, he kind of presents it in a way that's like, all right, you make your own interpretation of what this means for you. But plenty of details from Endgame have made headlines since before it even hit bookshelves, but nothing has resulted in as much scandal as the passage of the book that discusses conversations that Meghan first made note of in her interview with Oprah, which involved a member or members of the royal family allegedly speculating about the color of their baby's skin. It's a moment seen around the world that immediately had everybody wondering who could have been involved in such a shocking conversation. Meghan and Harry essentially didn't speak of the matter again, and neither did the royals. A version of Endgame translated into Dutch leaked prior to its release, and despite Omid leaving the names of the two members of the royal family who were alleged to have taken part in the conversation out of the final version of the book, those names were included in the Dutch translation. As it later turned out, somehow the Dutch publisher and translators were given an earlier draft not yet reviewed by lawyers, which was obviously never intended for public consumption, but somehow it made its way out. So yeah, Endgame has caused a stir, and then some. So since Omid and I follow each other on Twitter, I decided to reach out and see if he'd come on my podcast to talk about the book, the reaction to it, and just all things royals, and he generously agreed. So here we are. I had an enlightening and fruitful conversation with Omid, where we talked about if there's anything left to say about that translation controversy and his response to people claiming that it was a publicity stunt. We also discussed the common issues that the royal family's woes really boiled down to, whether Meghan Markle ever even stood a chance with Prince Harry's family, where the point of no return was for the couple, and where things go from here for everyone involved. If you are even slightly intrigued by the royals, you'll definitely find this one interesting. And if you love them or find yourself to be firmly on either side of the aisle when it comes to Harry and Meghan and William and Kate, you'll probably come away feeling even more passionately on your side. But anyway, I hope you still enjoy my chat with Omid Scobie, and I promise you, you're going to want to read his new book in full. It's called Endgame, Inside the Royal Family and the Monarchy's Fight for Survival, which I've linked in the show notes for your convenience. It is a total must read. I want to gab. Today we're gabbing with Omid Scobie, the author of the instant international best-selling book Endgame, Inside the Royal Family and the Monarchy's Fight for Survival, which came out at the end of November. He also authored the best-selling Finding Freedom, which came out in 2020, which focused on Meghan and Harry's relationship with one another and the royal family. I've been a longtime admirer of Omid's work and his fearlessness in reporting around the royals, so I'm thrilled to have him on the podcast today. Omid, thank you for being here. How are you?
It's so good to be here. And, you know, you and I have followed each other on Twitter for a long time, but we've never really sat in a space and actually had a full conversation before. So I'm glad we get to do it in front of how many people you've got listening to.
Exactly. No, it's fun to have those online interactions become at least somewhat in person, even though you're in LA, I'm in New York. Oh, man, you know, we talked a little bit before this, but I just wanted to check in, do a wellness check. How are you? Because I know that the press around Endgame has been overwhelming, to say the least. How are you holding up?
Well, thank you for asking. And wow, yeah, it definitely, listen, I was under no illusion that this was going to be an easy book to drop. It goes into areas that I knew would be triggering and uncomfortable for large sections of not only the British public, but also the British media. You know, it goes into that kind of the secret agreements between the palace and the press. And so it's only natural then that those same papers are going to do everything they can to kind of protect themselves, but also their secrets. And so you become almost collateral damage in that storytelling. And listen, I've been doing this full time on Royals 5-6 years now. It's not the first time. I had a similar experience with the last book, Finding Freedom. But yeah, this was definitely very intense. I won't lie, I was a little relieved when the wheels went up on the plane at Heathrow Airport to head back to LAX. But, you know, we live to tell the story.
Exactly. And it's one of those things also where it's like these days releasing a book, so many out of context quotes and excerpts and things get released before the actual book gets released. And that's, it's not just with your book, that kind of happens kind of with every celebrity memoir. Mm-hmm. It happened with Prince Harry's memoir earlier this year. That also makes things difficult too, right? Because it's like, I mean, I read Endgame and it's like half the things that have made headlines in the past several weeks within context aren't as damning or, you know,
no,
scandalous as they may be portrayed as.
Yeah, you know, I was frustrated in those the kind of 10 days or so before the book came out. There were all these front pages and headlines in the UK about things that were supposedly in the book that weren't even in there. I remember there was one front page of, I think it was the Daily Mail, one of those papers, and it said, you know, the royal author's scathing attack on Kate. And supposedly there's a line in the book where I said, all she's good for is to stand there and grin because she's too afraid to do anything else. And there was just nothing in the book that even fits that description or anything I've said in an interview. And then a few days later, we had the French serialization came out. And those were some extracts that were in a French magazine that then someone ran through Google Translate and turned into stories again in the paper. So I was glad when the book came out. And it's been nice to actually, I don't often look at my DMs, but I have been recently because there have been so many messages and people saying, listen, I wasn't sure what to expect with this book, but what I'm reading here is so different to Good. What has been portrayed in the press. So it's nice to see that at least some of that gets through.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just so thoroughly researched and you know what you're talking about. So it's like something I want to talk about with you is just like, it seems like people, at least the British press particularly, sort of really wants to make you part of the story a lot of the time. You know, it seems like it's almost like a distraction, in my opinion. How do you feel about that? Is that like a calculated effort on their part? Are aides in their ear trying to get you kind of becoming the new villain? Like, what's behind that?
Yeah, it's a bit of all of it. You know, I think the one lazy tactic that we see time and time again from British tabloids is they will weaponize you against yourself and your words, whether that's your story or your reporting. And for me, the easiest way for that has always been to be like, well, he's just Meghan's friend, he's just repeating her words, or he's their mouthpiece, their cheerleader, etc. And no matter how many times I have literally, like, at this point, like, practically got my phones and my text messages right. out to prove that I'm not the couple's friend, it will always come back to that. Because if you can then dismiss it as like, well, if he's a biased friend, then there's no reason to listen to him, then it kind of dismisses and delegitimizes the reporting. And what's so frustrating about that is that some of that stuff is written by royal correspondents who I've been in the press pens with since 2011.
We know that. You know these people. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've been in the same space that they've seen the access I've had. They've seen what I'm capable of doing. But I think really ever since Harry and Meghan's story became the main story, you know, I that was at a time where I think I was also when I went full time on Royals. It was when I found that my narrative that I was often reporting was different to what was in the press. And that's because a lot of what's in the press simply comes from the communications offices at the palaces or royal sources. And in Harry and Meghan's case, there weren't many journalists that had an inside track on what Meghan was thinking and saying and doing, or the same with them as a couple. And, you know, my background's entertainment news. I was an editor at Us Weekly for 10 years. So when those two got together, it really brought both of my beats together.
Convergence.
I had an advantage over others, but somehow when it came to that being represented in the press, it was like just the lazy story about being the friend.
It's sort of any divergence from the narrative is just going to be rejected and delegitimized in some capacity. So I think it's probably best we just talk about this right off the bat before we get into the other stuff I want to talk about. But obviously, your book has ruffled feathers, as we've alluded to. And I think the biggest thing that I've really seen is, you know, the Dutch translation came out where it names two members of the royal family who had supposedly had this conversation about Archie's skin color, which was first alluded to by Meghan in her interview with Oprah. You had initially said, like, I didn't write that. I don't know how this got out. And then you recently wrote an article for The Eye where you sort of explained what happened, which was basically like, in an earlier draft, it had not been reviewed by lawyers. those two people had been named, but you didn't know that was being sent around. You were not the one that sent that around. Is there anything left to be said about that whole situation, or maybe more broad, what do you make of the focus on that particular detail and the sort of unfolding of that storyline?
Listen, I certainly have said all I need to say on it, but I don't mind breaking it down with you. You know, obviously the day I was in New York, I was doing press, and I remember seeing a tweet and someone had made reference to something that was in a name that was in the Dutch version. And my heart sank because I thought, oh God, like, what has happened? And so I fired off emails to everyone on my team. And we then heard back from the Dutch translator, and they said their words were there had been an error in the translation. So then I'm armed up. I go on TV. Right. I'm able to explain. I'm also able to say that the book's been removed and that they're reprinting it. We then find out later in the day that it's not just that one thing that it's in the book. There is also another potential name. There's also other things that have somehow been in this book. So my mind's ticking and I'm thinking, well, there was never a version of this book that I signed off on and finished editing that had this stuff in it. So how did the Dutch have it? Because I was only ever aware of what I was finishing going to the Dutch. And so it took days to figure this out. And of course, in the middle of it, I'm being asked left, right, and center, was this a publicity stunt? So many people really believed that it was. And, you know, listen, I've said many times that it wasn't, and it wasn't. And if it was, it would have been a stupid one, because I think it actually took away from the conversations that the book should have been prompting. It turned it into a very kind of heated and hysterical situation. I actually think in the UK it affected sales massively. It was a really frustrating and I would say a little upsetting that it happened, because I'd worked so hard on this book. We'd spent 2 months in meetings with two different independent barristers or attorneys, as you guys would say, an in-house legal team, making sure that this was watertight, that there was nothing in this book that could be legally challenged. And so, yeah, if there are things like names that don't make the cut, then so be it. You know, you have to be able to show and tell when it comes to proving anything that you're putting in a book. And I think what was even more frustrating was that I actually didn't think it mattered that much that the names weren't in the book. Listen, we were all curious about it. Of course. But the bigger conversation was, the first woman of color or person of color to marry into that family went on national global television and said that there were concerns. And the concerns part is a bit that often gets missed out when we repeat the story,
right,
about the darkness of her unborn child's skin. Now, regardless of whoever said that, and of course, it's only one person's side of the story, it was just gobsmacking to me that it was never resolved, that it was never considered important enough within this institution to actually have a conversation with someone that was clearly hurt and offended, the one person of color that has every right to be, if that's how they saw those conversations or if that's really how they were. And so you think, well, why didn't someone even care enough to want to even clear their own name? But I was accused of that. Right. I know I wouldn't sleep until I've cleared the air on it. And then it also speaks to the bigger issue, which is, here's an institution that is supposedly representative of Britain. Well, Britain is a melting pot. It is a multicultural society. It is not the same as it was 100 years ago. Neither is the Commonwealth, the predominantly black and brown Commonwealth realm of 2.1 billion people that the monarch is the head of as well. So these are why I felt it mattered. And also, listen, there's a huge responsibility that Harry and Meghan had when they first brought up this story to Oprah.
Of course.
And then they never brought it up again. It was never in the Netflix special. It wasn't in the memoir. So I also, as a journalist, wanted to get to the bottom of, like, where did we get with this? What went on behind the scenes? And that was how the letters came into my orbit. And I was able to talk about it in the book, because at least we know that Meghan and Charles had had conversations about it,
even
if they didn't see eye to eye.
Right. Yeah. And even if that never became public until recently. So do you think they didn't bring it up again because those letters were actively being sent between Charles and Meghan? There was still an ongoing kind of dialogue about it behind the scenes.
Well, it happened only a few months after Oprah, those letters. There weren't many, but it at least felt that they, despite not seeing eye to eye on it, Charles felt that there would have been, so that it was impossible that there would have been any maliciousness if that kind of conversation was had in the family. And for Meghan, it was simply highlighting the unconscious bias may have played a role in this. And if there is, like, let's make it conscious and talk about it. That was felt that it was enough. And that any other party involved in this conversation had also made it very clear that they didn't want to talk about it.
Right.
So they're really, for them, it was like they can't keep on beating the same drum. And sometimes it feels like they do because we as press keep talking about it.
Right. Exactly.
And then you realize, well, they haven't spoken about it since 2021.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah. And you write about how like they waited a day to see how the British public was going to react to that story to even release a statement about anything. So it's kind of, it all plays into itself. But, you know, I think one of my favorite and like most illuminating chapters was chapter 7, which is race and the royals. And you do an excellent job of sort of demystifying the idea that that racism does not exist in Britain. And there's a really deep history of the royals' connections to slavery and different things in more recent eras that are would be considered racist. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, even if you're being the most cynical you can be, you know, Meghan coming into the fold was a huge missed opportunity for the family to maybe right some of those wrongs, or at least like right the ship and you know, be better about these topics in the future. Was there a distinct turning point with Meghan and like the handling of her coming in that respect? Or do you think that like they just never were going to give her a chance?
I think that there's a history there of like women really having a steep hill to climb when they marry into that family. And you need to look at Fergie and Diana and now Meghan to see that regardless of race or background, you know, Diana was as quote unquote thoroughbred as they come. And it still didn't work for her. You know, it's not only what your background is or what's expected of you. There's also this expectation to submit, to fall in line, to maintain the stiff upper lip, to not emote, to not feel. These are almost kind of like inhuman expectations. And so Meghan, I think, probably had more against her from the start than she ever would have known. I think there was obviously some naivety there. So when you add in the fact that she was American and the fact that she was half black and the fact that she was, you know, a Hollywood actress and, you know, all of the stereotypes that come with that. Yeah, it obviously, she was kind of almost doomed from the start. When you look at where she was entering, she was not joining some progressive company overseas. This was like the last institution in Britain that had yet to kind of truly modernize. And it was one of the things that made the story so interesting to me because, you know, being in the press pack, I'm half Iranian myself. My mother was an immigrant. Perhaps my lens on things is slightly different. You know, my dad's Scottish, so I feel like I have a good grasp of British culture and society,
right,
which I grew up in. But I also see it from another side as well. And I felt that for Meghan's story, it was important to be able, for someone on the ground that was there in a front row seat, to report on it fairly, but also closer to where her perspective may have been as well. Because I think that in this day and age, we're so quick to dismiss other people's feelings on things because we don't understand them. We never want to try and see it from someone else's perspective, especially when that person is from a minority group. And so I thought it almost felt like a responsibility, actually.
Right. And, you know, at the beginning of that answer, you named Fergie, Diana, Meghan, but you didn't name Kate. And I feel like there's this protectiveness of Kate that to somebody who had no idea who she was, you'd think that she was quote unquote one of them. And she was sort of part of that bloodline to begin with because of the way that they protect her and in a different way to all the other women that you just named. Why is that? Is that because she did fall in line more? Does she check different boxes than the rest of those women didn't check?
I think sometimes it just boils down to personality. You look at Diana, she had a voice, she wanted to use it. There were things that she was extremely passionate about, even if they weren't checking the boxes of the royals' interest. With Sarah Ferguson, she had a kind of cheeky, bubbly sensibility that I think that just automatically made her a little bit of a kind of thorn in the paws of the institution. And she did say and do silly things at times as well. And then with Meghan, it was like, here was a woman who had already like accomplished so much and wasn't going to come in like a young little trainee ready to kind of cross her legs and her hands and just wait and be told what to do. That's just not what we expect. That's just not how a grown adults in their 30s enter a business or a job to behave, especially, you know, an accomplished woman. I think with Kate, she joined this so early. Her relationship with, as we're seeing in these new episodes of The Crown, the kind of like even unconscious training to kind of prepare for that day began so early for her. And I think that she was willing and capable. And there was some criticism in the book about the chapter on Kate. And, you know, some people said, well, you practically call her cold. And, you know, how could you? Actually, I talk about what I describe as a stately detachment that she has that I think has actually served her really well in this role. Because if you look at the last family member that had that quote unquote stately detachment, it was Queen Elizabeth II herself. You know, we knew nothing about her. We knew she liked horse racing and we didn't really know anything else about her passions when it came to politics or social issues. We didn't really know her opinions on anything. And that allowed the nation, the world to project onto her what it was that they needed from her in that role. And I think Kate is on the path to being able to achieve that herself when she herself becomes queen alongside King William one day. And so it's been incredibly successful for her. But I can't help as a human just wonder, at what cost does that come at?
Because
we're almost describing robots at this point, you know?
Yeah.
And you know that she has been through some really hard times. You know, I remember being with her in Malaysia. It was the same day that she had found out that there was photos of her that had been taken sunbathing without a swimsuit in the south of France, and they were published in a French tabloid. And her private aide, it was like 2014 or maybe even earlier, her private secretary and her press secretary came over to me on the morning because I was joining them for an engagement at a mosque in Kuala Lumpur. And I was the only journalist going into that with them. And he said, I've had to tell them in the morning that these pictures were coming. Mm. And they said that William was furious, but Kate was very much like, okay, well, you have it under control and I trust you to be doing the right things. And like an hour later, she's coming out the car and like nothing had happened. It's so rare, even with celebrities, even in any public space, it is very hard to find people who are truly capable of compartmentalizing
at that level. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's a skill, but it's also something that's so fascinating to me that I do want to analyze it and study it in a way. Yeah.
Yeah. And especially in an age when authenticity and sort of breaking that sort of fourth wall is valued more than ever. And it's almost like, this is how it's always done. And these are the qualities that made the queen so amazing and are preparing Kate for the role that she will inevitably inherit. But you wish that there was just a little bit more room for a little bit more humanity, a little bit more authenticity, a little bit more of that kind of human quality.
And I think, you know, people often ask, you know, they want to know about Kate and Meghan and where it went wrong. And I talk in the book about the times where Meghan's going to her absolute lowest points. And here we have a mental health ambassador, someone that is hoping to be a pioneer in the early years sector when it comes to understanding the development of children from womb to the age of 4 or 5. And so you have an outsider going through mental health problems, who's next door, who's pregnant, and had absolutely no support or even interest from her sister-in-law. Listen, there's no rule that sisters-in-law have to be there.
Of course
for
not.
Each other. In fact, they're often not close. Siblings-in-law just aren't.
They're in such rare positions. Each other. Yeah.
But to be in such a unique position, I can't be alone in thinking, how is that possible?
You're not. Oh, and in reading Endgame, this is a generalization, but it felt like two of the biggest sort of overall hurdles that this family, that kind of blocks this family from progressing and from sort of changing some of those things are ego and tradition. It seems like everything kind of boils down to sort of an inherent competitiveness within the family of, like, you know, whose public persona is more favorable at any given moment. And also just, this is how things have always been done. So why would we change them? Would you agree with that assessment? That those are two of the kind of biggest hurdles for them.
Yeah, I'm glad that was your takeaway, actually, because, you know, listen, I remember a year ago when I was doing the coverage of the Queen's passing, and I don't think there was one person that I spoke to around that time that would have been able to say the Queen had an ego. Mm. It was never about, and that's quite something when you are literally like the Queen of an entire country for 70 years, and you are literally probably one of the most famous women on the planet. When you think of Britain, you think of like red phone boxes, black taxi cabs, and the Queen and the Beatles, maybe, or One Direction. I don't know. Like, she's just like, she was bigger than the family itself. And so for her to not have an ego, it served her so well, because she was always above the fray. She never cared about press coverage. She never cared about what the polls were saying. When you look at the current crop of working royals, you have King Charles, a man who pretty much since his marriage to Diana has been almost obsessed with media coverage and what people think and say about him. And that has affected so many of his relationships in his life, particularly with his own children. You know, I talk about in the book some of the times where those children have been collateral damage and sort of
directly
PR crises. And, you know, Harry spoke about it eloquently in his memoir as well. And then you also have one thing that is very different today, which is for the Queen, it was always, as I said, it was never about her. She was always working towards serving the nation and the crown itself.
Right.
Her duty was for that. It feels like now there is much more of a kind of selfish PR-driven agenda for each of them. And you only need to look at, listen, it's no secret that Charles is far less popular than his mother was.
Oh, yeah.
But then you look at William and Kate, they do have an immense amount of popularity. So why isn't there a situation in which these two very popular royals are trying to support and up the popularity of two less popular royals, especially in the case of Camilla? And there's been this really interesting separation between the two. We've not seen father and son on engagements. In fact,
it's wild.
Even some of the briefings that come out from William's office at Kensington Palace have really gone against what Charles is about or saying. You know, 3 days after the coronation, we had details given to us by William's team that, oh, well, when his coronation happens, it'll be very different. It'll be much more mindful of the economic climate that we're in. And like, guys, they haven't even tweened out Westminster Abbey yet.
The prep is already underway for preparing for William to become king. And it's like, hey, but we don't know. Is that going to be in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? We don't know.
20, yeah, exactly. And I've never seen this situation where there's, certainly in my life, of course, in history, it's common, but where there's been an heir who is like not only like chomping at the bit to take on this role, which is great to see that eagerness, but literally like stepping on the heel of the person that they will succeed. So it is very interesting dynamic. And as we've seen, often these dynamics do get in the way of what is right or what is best for the institution at large. Mm-hmm. Can bring an institution down.
Definitely. And to me, I feel like one of the biggest turning points that kind of ties into this idea is like when Harry and Meghan went on their trip to Australia, New Zealand, and Fiji, the level of popularity they were seeing was Diana level, and the family was directly threatened by that. And right when they got back, that is when the coverage of them became uber negative very quickly. And there was a distinct turning point there. Is it ego that prevents the royal family from seeing a moment like that, an international tour that everyone's paying attention to, that people are loving them? What prevents the royal family from seeing that as a positive for the collective? Is it that? Mm. Is it just ego?
Yeah, it goes back to what we were just saying, I think, where the queen would see that as like, how wonderful that this helps the institution, the crown at large. Whereas with other family members, like, well, why haven't I got that? And why is no one watching my engagements this week? And so it's all about ego. It's all about one's own personal gain. And listen, it's quite normal to be competitive, but then it's also not that normal to be this competitive in a family simply because of the hierarchy and the way it's ordered. It creates that. So for Harry and Meghan, who at the time, Harry at the time was sixth in line to the throne, it was felt like, well, why should the sixth be getting so much attention? And it's almost hard to remember a time where Harry and Meghan were that popular because it's now like so the opposite. But it really was at that. I think that tour was like the absolute peak of it all. And
I remember
someone on their team saying to me, like, this is great, but I'm also scared that this is going
to. There's only one way to go after that, right? Exactly.
Especially when you've got people within your own fold who are willing to help make that happen.
Right. And the Harry and Meghan story from there has been told ad nauseum. But I do want to. You write that sort of one of the just really basic main things that they wanted was, you said, for so long, Harry made it clear that he and Meghan simply wanted to just be heard, that they wanted the opportunity to sit down and talk through the past from both perspectives and find a way to move forward. For Harry, it was about seeking accountability and, where appropriate, apologies. And Charles refused. What was the point of no return for Harry and Meghan as it pertains to Harry's family?
Yeah, I think that point of no return was quite early on, actually. And I talk about this in the book, where when Harry realizes that the calls are coming from inside the house, when he realizes that it's the people on his brother's team who are responsible for some of the most negative and damaging stories about them entering the public domain. And so then you realize, well, no one has my back in this situation. It's almost like the only result of staying within that is to completely fall, to come out of it so bruised and battered that there's nothing left for you. And I think that was when they started to explore the possibilities of, like, do they move to Southern Africa and are they based out there for a while, or do they start a life in Canada and do this half in, half out scenario that they wanted to, that they ran by the Queen at one point. And ultimately, this was because they didn't want to disrespect the Queen. So it was only when the institution said to them, like, it's either here or the highway, they took the highway. And unfortunately, since then, there has been no real, like, repair or movement in the right direction.
Yeah.
I think a lot of that has been caused by the fact that they did need that time to tell their stories. And to do that is chaotic. It does cause harm and anger and all the rest of it amongst the family. I think that there truly are people within the royal family who don't see the fact that they have briefed and leaked things over the years as themselves speaking.
Right.
It's just part of the job.
It's their age or whatever.
They see it as, well, Harry and Meghan have gone out and spoken and we can't. So then there's more resentment and bitter feeling towards that. And so you're now in this situation where, when Harry's book came out at the start of the year, he said himself he wanted those conversations, he wanted accountability. And, it's now the end of the year and it hasn't happened.
Right.
And I think that for him, and there's a moment at the end of his chapter in this book where it's, I describe a conversation that he had with his friend where he sort of has reached this point now where it's like, if it's not going to happen, then who cares?
Right.
Who knows?
Yeah.
The future.
Yeah. In our final few minutes, I just want to talk about what going forward in the future for some of these people. And, it's interesting. You mentioned public favor has gone down so much around Harry and Meghan. I feel like they, even when they left, it felt like even a lot of Americans felt really a little bit more positively about them and were kind of excited about the prospect of them coming to this country and having a Netflix deal and a Spotify deal. And they were really going to be back in the media in a different way. And at some point, somebody, for lack of a better term, sort of like fumbled the bag. It felt like the plan didn't go to plan. It felt like there was something that was askew because it feels like we were supposed to hear from them a little bit more. It feels like they were probably plans for other things. What do you know about any of that going again, not according to plan in terms of Harry and Meghan's sort of emergence in America and maybe what they have planned for 2024 and beyond to correct that?
I mean, I think looking at it from just like a PR perspective, doing it in the middle of a pandemic and then the last year of the writer's strike and all the rest of it, when you're running a production company, like they've definitely had like everything going against them.
Yeah.
I also think that, listen, in an ideal world, I think if they were able to like land in America, release the Netflix series and the book all in that 1 year, it would have like been at the pace that I think people were willing to accept. By the time these projects that take so long to finish, is not for anyone's fault, by the time that comes out, I do understand why at one point for much of the public who are dealing with like much bigger, more important things, you know, there's in the Britain, there's the economic crisis, there's cost of living crisis, there's war, there's, you know, such divided times when it comes to our politics on both sides of the pond. There comes a point where it starts to feel like rich people problems.
Right.
And, you know, I think whilst the stories and experiences that they share are so valid and worth talking about, if it's not landing with your audience, you do need to address the conversations that you're trying to have. You have to be able to read the room. It looks like they really have, actually. You know, I think for Meghan, he spent pretty much the best part of the year trying to avoid being attached to anything to do with royals or the royal story whatsoever. And we now see her at industry events and over here in LA and attending Netflix screenings. And, you know, it's kind of like really gone back to her roots, but in this more elevated way that she was looking for. And I'm curious to see what comes of that from a business perspective, because we know that she's been beavering away on stuff for so long. But then there is also, I'm sure, and without a doubt, there are people around them who are trying to figure out, like, how do we improve the support for you guys? How do we improve the likability ratings, if there
are? Of course, yeah, the Q score,
And so much, sadly, is caused by the press as well. You know, I'll use my book for an example. I'm really proud of this book. I think that I handled the subject as fairly as I could. But if I was to go back at home in the street right now, I know just from the DMs and threats that I've received, there are people that want to spit at me. There are people that are angry at me. There are, you know, and so, and I understand why it's got that way, because all they've seen of me has been what the papers have put out,
exactly,
which is I am this nasty, vicious, vindictive liar who's just out to cause problems or make a buck or whatever, which couldn't be further from the truth.
Of course.
But there's nothing I can do about.
Yeah.
So you sometimes are put in those situations, even not through your own doing. It's just...
I almost think, and I'm speaking of somebody who is generally sort of seen their point of view and been on their side of things. I just sometimes think that I wish they would break out of, I think sometimes they have the same strategies that they learned as part of the firm and part of the royal family, where it's like, you know, meet it with silence and kind of don't overshare. But I'm like, it would be great if Meghan had an Instagram account. It would be great if, you know what I mean? Like,
just clap back at something.
or even just like be posting more just normal things that, kind of, I think it makes every move that she makes a little bit less, okay, what is it? You know, what's she doing? Whatever. And that's sort of my point of view on it. But Omid, to end it out, you know, we're at the end of this year, we're at the end of 2023. It's been a big year. Harry's book came out in January. That feels like it was 10 years ago. And your book just came out. A lot has happened this year for the royals and for Harry and Meghan. What would you like to see them do in the new year that feels like it's in the realm of possibility in an effort to move forward or to progress in a positive way?
Yeah, Liz, I think my realistic expectation is that the royal family at least become more open to having conversations about things that have made them feel very uncomfortable for recent years, that have made them run away and sweep things under the carpet, etc. I don't think it does them any help in the long run. You know, I think even when it comes to just the conversations around race, when it comes to conversations around the family's colonial legacy, which we see follows them everywhere. You know, to be a monarch of 14 Commonwealth realms and not want to engage in that conversation is so offensive. Mm-hmm. And I look at, say, King Willem Alexander of the Netherlands. I'll keep it short, but a year ago, he stood in front of the nation in the Netherlands and he apologized not only for his family's connection to the slave trade, but also took ownership of the fact that that time still has an effect on race relations in the country today, and that he was putting money behind a research project to really getting deeper into that. To me, that is a mature and admirable way of handling something like that without getting involved in culture wars and all the stuff that I know that people want to steer clear from. So I hope that there's some growth within the royal family on that front. We can't lean on the pomp and pageantry and theatrics forever. Otherwise, you do end up, like I say, the end game right now is that you either go on to glory or you end up, like many other European monarchies, fading to insignificancy or becoming just a tourist attraction. Hmm. And as for Harry and Meghan, I think they just need to get on with the work that excites them.
I agree.
Don't be worried about will it be a success or will it not. Just like do what you love. Mm-hmm. And let people see it. I know they put out a report for their charitable foundation just a few days before we record this. And they were, within it was like so many different projects that this charity had been doing, but none of it had been announced. And you just think, let the people know.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't want them to let fear sort of guide them. They should just, I think people will embrace this amazing work they're doing. Omid Scobi, thank you so much for taking the time today. Congratulations on the success of the book. I'm glad that you were holding up just as a human and did all this attention, because it can't be easy. But I really admire you. And I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you for having me on. I'm sad we didn't get to talk much about housewives today.
Next, I'll have you back on to talk about housewives whenever you want.
Perfect. I'm up to date on all my
I love it. I love it. Omid, thank you so much.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to the show. Subscribe to Gabbing with Gib on any podcast platform to listen to new episodes, and subscribe to Gabbing with Gib on YouTube to watch full-length versions of our interviews. We'd also love your support with a 5-star review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. You can follow me at Gib Sonoma on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok, and keep up with all things Gabbing with Gib at Gabbing with Gib on Instagram and TikTok. Gabbing with Gib is an independent podcast hosted by me, Gibson Johns. It's produced by myself and Riley Dabbs. Graphics are by Rachel Roth, and our cover art photography is by Troy Hallahan. If you want to reach out about guest booking, sponsorship, or advertising opportunities, email us at gabbingwithgib@gmail.com. Thank you again for your support, and see you next time.